This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode, we're speaking to Chris Bolton from Curramine Beach in Far North Queensland about his sustainable and premium quality coral trout, the sustainability of the reef fish fishery, and what he does to keep that quality through to market. All right, welcome to another Food Fight podcast. I'm your host, Steph Bostuma. Thank you so much for joining me. This is a really special one today here on Good Friday. We always begin our podcast with an acknowledgement of country, so I'd like to acknowledge the Mamu people, who are the traditional custodians of the land where we gather and speak here today, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. All right, well, if you guys don't recognize this bloke, this is Chris Bolton, and we find ourselves for this Food Fight podcast at Curramine Beach here in tropical North Queensland, the furthest we've ever been for a podcast. Chris, thank you so much for having me, mate. It's a pleasure.
No, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Steph. Thank
yeah,
you.
Very exciting. So for people who don't know what you do, and I know that a lot of people who listen to this podcast do, tell us a bit about what you do and you know, why do you reckon I want to talk to you?
So I'm a commercial fisherman, specialising in line caught reef fish on the Great Barrier Reef. We also catch bait, high quality bait for game fishermen, you know, marlin, sailfish, things like that. Yeah, everything we do is, of course, high quality, premium product, low quantity, high quality.
Yeah, cool. All right, I'm going to take you through. We want to go through everything here. I've got some notes on my phone. I'm going to have to keep tapping into it just in case. I always lose it. Okay, here we go. So I want to know about when you started fishing. I mean, I started fishing because my dad was a fisherman as well, but it was the same case for yours?
Yeah, Steph. No, I've been fishing, geez, since before I can remember. My old man, well, my whole family, grandfathers, parents, uncles, everything were fishermen. And born into it, basically.
Yeah. And that, were they commercial fishermen?
Yeah, there was a couple of commercial fishermen. A couple of them were just recreational that were dead set against commercial fishermen.
Yeah, right.
So I've had both sides, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And let's talk a bit about where we are. So tell us about Curramine Beach. We've just driven here. It's about an hour and a half south of Cairns. And you know, you've got all your gear here. Tell us about where you fish.
Yeah, Curramine Beach is just a little, what would you say? It's very quiet, little sleepy town. I think it's only 300 or 400 people population.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's on the edge of the Barrier Reef. Actually, we've got a reef right on the coast. You can walk to one of the reefs at low tide from Curramine. I think it's one of the only places anywhere that you can walk.
Yeah,
to a reef.
King Reef. I was having a look. It's sort of the closest to the coast the Barrier Reef comes, basically anywhere.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've basically fished out of here, you know, from since I was a kid with the parents and grandparents. And one of my grandparents lived down here at Curramine. So every school holidays we were down here going going to the reefs. I fish the same reefs now, same methods, catch the same fish as I did. Way back then.
Wow. And so how long does it take to get to your fishing grounds from the shore here?
Oh, the close ones, Steph, I can be out there fishing in 45 minutes.
Right.
If I go a long way out, I'm sort of 4 hours, but I sort of fish from anywhere from Cairns to Townsville. I've got a fair area that I can fish from here. So.
Yeah, and you've just developed sort of that knowledge over the years, first as a kid and then as a commercial fisher of, like, you know, where your most productive grounds and things like that are.
Yeah, that's right. I sort of, you know, by the time I was 15, I knew where were the productive grounds and where we could catch different species and things like that. So even before I started my working career, I knew this area very well, you know. So now I know it a lot better, but yeah, that was a big help.
Yeah, cool. And so I think that the product that you're most well known for is the coral trout. You sort of, as you said, you catch bait, but also a sort of a range of other reef species and stuff as well.
Yeah.
But the coral trout's probably the thing people know you best for. Let's talk a bit about that fish. Is there a reason why that? Why do you think you're best known for the coral trout? And tell us a bit about the species itself.
I think coral trout's just known worldwide as probably one of the best fish in the ocean, you know.
Yeah.
It's well known, it's always been well known, coral trout. It's a nice clean flesh fish. I think it lacks taste, if anything.
Right. It's just too sort of white and clean and sweet.
Yeah, there's not a lot of taste to it. So, you know, you get a lot of people that don't like fishy, you hear
them
say that. That's coral trout's a fish that doesn't really taste like fish. So, coral trout's always been popular. I know when I was a kid, we'd go fishing and there wasn't much that came home except coral trout.
Mm.
Most other fish you'd throw back and was just coral trout or red emperor as well. You know, they were always kept. But, yeah, and they're such a prolific fish as well. They're fast-growing, very fast breeding. Yeah, they're just really, they're the ideal fish.
Mm. So it's like this sort of perfect harmony of, you know, fast growing, fast breeding, good eating. And what about, are they an easy species to catch compared to others? I think, like, I know that down south, if you want to target one species compared to another, you might struggle. Are they one of the easier fish to sort of target on the reef?
Yeah, definitely. You know, some days I can go out when I target coral trout and I can catch, say, 30 coral trout and maybe 3 other fish all day.
Right.
You can really target coral trout.
Yeah.
And the coral trout grounds are close. You know, within 45 minutes I can have a coral trout in the boat.
They're
a perfect fish, really. Yeah.
So all of this feeds into sustainability, which we'll sort of talk about a little bit later. But tell us about the different types of coral trout.
Yeah, there's a lot of different types. There's your common coral trout, which everyone sort of knows. You've got a blue spot, which is a darker coloured trout. Or they can be yellow and black coloured, which is footballer. It's just a different colour morph of the blue spot. They get up to, I've seen them up to about 25 kilos.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Massive.
At that size, they're known for Ciguatera. So we've actually got an 80 centimetre maximum size limit on them, about 6 kilo. So anything over that, we're not allowed to keep, which eliminates the, you know, probability of having Ciguatera. You've got the square tail or passion fruit trout. They're another beautiful looking trout. They've sort of got bigger spots on them that resemble passion fruit seeds. That's why they're called passion fruit trout.
Yeah, cool.
You've got coronation trout, which is the one up on top of the cover there that I've got molded.
Nice.
Bar cheek trout. They've got sort of little bars on their head rather than spots, which, funny story there, I used to believe it for a long time, but the old man told me when I was a kid that the reason why the spots had got elongated was because they were so fast. it smudges the spots on them.
That's a great one to tell the kids.
I think that's it. Five different ones that we get here.
Is there any flavour difference between the species?
The passion fruit trout definitely tastes different. It's more of a cod texture and taste. But I mean, side by side, Steph, 90% of people would have a lot of trouble picking the difference between any of them.
Yeah, really. Okay. Very similar. They look similar to me from what I've seen is, you know, if you had a silhouette of the fish, they'd look the same. It's more so the colourings and markings and things like
that. Basically, yeah. When you really know the fish, you do see the differences. Some of them were a bit thicker in the shoulder. Some of them were a bit thicker towards the tail. There's slight differences, but basically it's the colour.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to let's start talking about what a sort of a day looks like. Let's talk about your boat. So you've got a couple of different boats that you use for different purposes out here.
Yeah, that's right. The Noosa Cat, it's a 7.4 metre cat. It's sort of set up for nighttime fishing or overnight trips. So that's when we'll go out to the wide grounds. I'll take a deckhand with me on that boat. We'll go sort of 3 to 4 hours out, deep water, 70 to 100 metres of water. That's for red emperor, gull bean, saddle tail, things like that.
Cool.
The small boat, when it's a bit rougher, this probably seems a bit backwards, but when it's a bit rougher weather, I'll use the small boat.
Mm.
But that's because I can go to the closer grounds and target your coral trout and things like that. That's just by myself, I'll do that.
Yeah, okay.
And the little one's also used for catching bait and garfish.
Yeah.
Because that's all close as well. That's all around the islands and river mouths and things like that.
Yeah, cool. A bit of a diversity there. The trusty old centre console. The trusty little centre console gets a lot of the work done.
Yeah, no, the little boat makes as much money as the big one, believe it or not.
So yeah, there you go. Good. I'm not surprised. So you can just do that by yourself. You just get set up like anyone would go on fishing, and I suppose the gear, we'll start talking about your techniques and stuff, but the gear's pretty simple too.
Yeah, it's basic gear, Steph. It's, you know, line fishing especially, that's I don't know, my grandfather was doing that, like I say, the same reefs, the same gear, exactly the same gear back in the 50s.
Yeah.
So it's.
And it's all hand line, you're not even using rods.
All hand line, yeah, it's all hand line. You just...
Is there a reason for that?
Well, you'll get the fish into the boat a lot faster on a hand line, and because you're fishing in amongst the reef, the first thing... When that fish bites your line, the first thing it does is heads for that coral.
Yeah,
so with a rod, a lot of the time that fish will be in that coral before you can pull it back, whereas with a hand line, you sort of direct pull on it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very much the same when people target groper down on the south coast, like near Sydney and stuff where we're from. It's always on hand line with strong mono.
Yeah.
And it allows you to just keep them away from the rocks and keep them away from the holes and stuff like that.
That's right. Yeah. And the other thing is there's a fair shark problem now, depredation. Sharks taking fish off your lines.
Right.
With a hand line, you can pull the fish in a lot faster and you don't lose, well, you lose very little fish to sharks with a hand line. You know, with a rod, you'll lose up to 50-60% of the fish that you hook.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and so do you then just use like strong monofilament line?
That's right. Yeah, just strong mono line.
Yeah, and that doesn't deter the fish at all. They're pretty.
No, yeah. Steph. if you're in the right place,
the perfect fish, as you said, they'll take stuff off heavy mono.
And you know, if you're in the right place with the right bait, I think bait's a big thing. That's why I'm so particular about my bait as well. You know, it's like putting candy in front of a baby, really.
Yeah, right.
They're going to take it regardless. Yeah.
What sort of bait do you use?
You don't have I to use tell me if you
don't. Don't give up too much.
I use all sorts of bait. I use a lot of squid. for the deeper water fish, the squid's more for red emperor, saddle tail, gullband, things like that.
Yeah.
For the coral trout, I'll use mullet, pilchards, sardines, fish basically for coral trout. They're real fish eaters. That deeper water stuff more prefers squid.
Yep.
But it's all local stuff and all as fresh as I can get. You know, if I won't eat it myself, I don't expect the fish to eat
it. Yeah, right.
So, yeah.
That's the quality level. So yep. Does that mean that we can buy our bait off you for bait prices and put it on the table?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I know a lot of people do go to, we supply a lot of tackle shops with bait, but I know a lot of people do go to tackle shops and buy our bait and tell us how good it tastes.
Yeah. We'll talk a bit more about bait after. We'll finish off with sort of coral trout and some of that stuff, and then yep. We'll talk about some of the other species you get and a bit about the bait. But a part of that, you know, using the hand line and getting them away from the coral and stuff like that is, you know, not leaving anything on the reef as well. So do you want to just tell us a bit about, you know, like obviously that's important to you and, you know, using hand lines and making sure you pull the fish in the boat quickly, you don't lose gear on the reef and stuff like that. That's a big part of your process as well.
Yeah, that's right. We use fairly heavy lines. The shallow water is sort of 55 to 70 pound breaking strain line. You know, with a rod you're using generally less than 50 pounds, so you're getting a lot more break-offs, you're losing a lot more gear. The deeper water will use 300 pound line, so you very rarely lose gear in that deeper water. I use steel sinkers rather than lead. Lead's very bad for the environment. Mm. You know, we use scrap steel for that, so if we do lose gear, it rusts away in no time. Hooks the same. We only use steel hooks. If you do lose a fish with a hook in its mouth, well, that hook rusts out fast. So, yeah, heavy gear is important for that.
Do you make your own sinkers?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Where do you get your scrap from? Everywhere?
Oh, anywhere and everywhere, yeah. Yeah, it's, there's insane amounts of scrap steel lying around that just end up in landfill, and basically you pay nothing for it.
Yeah.
Whereas lead's very expensive as well. Yeah.
So. It's so interesting to talk to you about this, because being a recreational fisher myself, it's all about the gear for a lot of people, you know what I mean? It's like people want the newest rods, the newest Shimano Stratic reels and Tiagras and, you know, whatever, depending on what species they're targeting. And they, you know, they buy the most expensive braid, costs you $150 for a spool of braid or something like that.
Yep.
And this is all so they can go out and catch a bag limit for fun, you know, on the weekend and maybe feed their family. But then a lot of professionals like yourself, it's just back to basics, and it's about what's efficient and what works for you, and it's about everything from, you know, choosing fresh bait to knowing spots and things like that. And at the end of the day, it's not so much about the gear.
No, that's right. I've got a couple of mates actually that are like you just explained. They've got to have the latest, greatest, all the bells and whistles and colourful things and shiny things and all the rest of it. And I've taken a few people on the boat before, and they look at my gear and sort of give me a few funny looks. And by the end of the trip, they're sort of hanging their heads a bit.
They're converted. Yeah. They're like, they're about to go out and buy a hand line on the way to the scrap metal yard.
Yeah. No, it is. It's, I don't know, Steph. I think a lot of them things are marketing things. If I was to use a lot of the stuff that recreational fishermen use, I'd go broke.
Yeah, just not going to catch as many fish.
No.
That's so cool. Like, and even things like making sinkers out of steel, like that's just, you know, instead of purchasing new brand new made stuff that's had a high number of resources put into it, you know, you're repurposing something that's just either rusting out the back of someone's house somewhere in a you know, car yard or whatever it might be.
That's right.
To whatever, just recycling those things. And if it works for you, then it's just those small little sort of one percenters that you can add to that sustainability factor of what you do.
That's right, yeah. So with the steel, it's just scrap steel, which if you look at any building site, there's scrap steel everywhere. Yep. Yeah, like you say, any scrap metal yard, there's steel everywhere. And then what I'll do, the hardware stores, when they sell lengths of chain, when they cut the chain, that one link's cut in half. Mm. So I get them to collect all them bits of scrap.
Really?
And that little half a chain link gets welded onto the bit of steel. That's what you tie your line onto.
So and that becomes your eye.
Yeah.
So, wow.
Yeah, no, there's... I don't pay for much of the sinkers. Yeah, yeah. Whereas if you were to go and buy lead sinkers especially, you'd be, yeah, it'd cost a lot of money. And you know, as I explained to a few people, put a lead sinker in a fish tank and see how long your fish last. They won't last long.
Yeah, right. That's a good point, isn't it? Mm. I mean, it's lead.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
We know lead's bad. There's a reason why we don't have it in our pipes anymore.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, that's fascinating. And I guess a part of the, you know, it contributes to that sustainability factor, but also as someone who produces low volume, high quality, it just, it allows you to reduce your costs at the end of the day as well. So it all contributes.
Yeah, that's right. That's one of our biggest hurdles is trying to keep the cost down.
Yeah.
You know, we're focusing on high quality. Well, you got a lot of costs. So everything we can do is, helps not only us, but helps everyone in line.
Yeah, cool. Let's talk about your processing and what happens when you get a fish on the boat. So you're actually before we move on, do you lose much gear?
Not a lot, Steph. Our biggest loss of gear is probably from sharks.
Yeah.
You know, when you hook a shark, they'll generally, because we don't use wire trace or anything, they'll generally bite the mono off. But those hooks, you know, we only use steel hooks, we don't use stainless, so it doesn't take long for a hook to rust out of a shark or a fish's mouth. You know, if you do, not often we get snapped off by fish, but it does happen. If it does happen, a steel hook will rust out of a fish's mouth fairly fast.
Yeah. Cool. All right, well, let's talk about the you know, the process once you get it on board, and this is all a part of, we're sort of telling the story of this quality that you bring to your product, because more people have probably definitely have interacted with your product at a table at a restaurant than have in any other way, whether it be distribution or being out on a boat with you. So, you know, once you get it in, what happens?
Yeah, well, I've got the brain spike, the Icky Jimmy spike, and a pair of scissors right there, right beside me. So I lift the fish into the boat with one hand and the other hand's reaching for that brain spike. So you'll brain spike the fish, which it completely stops any stress on the fish. You know, it's humane, it's dead instantly. Then I'll drop that, grab the scissors, cut the gills, which bleeds the fish, and from then I'll take the hook out of its mouth, place it in the icy cold brine. So, you know, from the second that fish takes the bait to when it goes into ice and it starts cooling down, it's generally sort of not much more than 30 seconds, and it's started that cooling process. So it's all fast, and that's one of the big things that helps us with quality. It's all done so fast.
Tell me about using scissors, because I've seen this on your Instagram. You use scissors to cut the gills. Where whenever I've bled fish in the past, it's always cut across the throat. Is it just basically the same result but a quicker process, or?
Yeah, so when you cut the gills, it bleeds them just the same. You know, I don't show a lot on that Instagram because people don't like seeing blood and guts too much, but...
We can have a whole nother conversation about that, and we have on this podcast.
it you know, a lot of fish will squirt blood out of them gills a couple of metres, so it bleeds them just as well as cutting the throat, but if you cut the throat, you're opening up the flesh, and especially near the guts, you're increasing the risk of bacteria entering into a fish's flesh. So you really don't want any cuts into a fish, especially near its gut cavity.
Yeah, okay.
So that's basically why we do it. If you cut the throat, you'll have reduced shelf life.
Right. And why? What's he so important about getting the blood out of a fish as soon as you get it on board?
Well, blood will make a fish taste fishy. If you can get rid of, the more blood you can get rid of, the cleaner taste it will be.
Yeah, okay.
And again, shelf life. The more blood left in a fish's flesh, the you'll have reduced shelf life. If you can have that really clean flesh, no blood in it, no cuts in the flesh, that'll increase your shelf life dramatically.
And do you do that same process with all the species that you catch?
Yep, every fish we catch is done like that. Every single fish.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Have you ever experimented with the, I can't remember the name of the technique, the Japanese name of the technique of wiring the spinal column?
Shinkijimi, that is. Yeah, yeah. I have, Steph. I'll do that on order because it's not a quick process. Like the brain spiking and bleeding, that's fairly fast, fairly easy. The shinkijimi, the wire down the spine, is a, it's a lot slower process. It slows us down a lot, so there's got to be an added cost. Mm. And it does definitely improve quality even further, but from that ikijimi brain spiking and bleeding and then going that extra step to shinkijimi, I think not a lot of people see the value in it.
Yeah,
so
okay.
It's not overly popular. It's more popular in bluefin tuna and things like that.
When you've got a bit more time.
Yeah.
Because it's one large fish.
One large fish, yeah. You know, a lot of these fish that we catch are only, they sort of only average 2 kilos. So, you know, it does add a big cost. It does improve quality for sure, but... and yeah, every now and again I'll get a chef that asks for it specifically. Yeah, right. So he'll say, can you do me 3 red emperor and 2 coral trout like that? And I'll do it when I catch them.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's like, it's fascinating because for people that don't listen to, you know, this podcast where we go into depth about these sorts of things or read too much into it, they just sort of, a lot of the time they might think, well, you know, the chef got a list and it says red emperor, ocean trout, coral trout and whatever, and you just sort of tick a box and say how many you want. But like when it comes to dealing with you, because you're a small producer of small volume and you've got control of everything, people can call up and say, hey, next time you land a red emperor, I want you to cut its tail open or however you do it and send a wire up its spinal column and things like that, and you do that to order. So it sort of just speaks to... when it comes to that level of quality, it's control, like the ability of you and to be able to communicate with chefs about what they're after and what they want, and then to be able to even sort of customize quality further for people that are willing to pay for it and stuff.
That's right. I think that's a big thing for a lot of chefs too. You know, same as the, for instance, passion fruit trout. I get a few chefs, next time you get one of them, can you let me know and I'll buy it? They can contact me at any time and ask for a specific fish done in a specific way, even caught on a certain day. You know, quite often I'll get contacted, we'll need X amount of coral trout on this day, can you do it? It's like, yep, no worries, we can do that. And I think it is good.
Yeah, it's definitely a part of the appeal because, you know, one thing that chefs struggle with is inconsistency.
Yeah.
You know, if they order a certain product and it doesn't come in when or at the quality that they need it at or whatever, it sends a whole spanner into the works of running a restaurant.
Yeah.
But at least, you know, you might have inconsistency when it comes to your ability to get out with weather and things like that, but at least you can communicate to chefs, all right, well, this is when we're fishing this week, and if you want to get your orders in and stuff like that, then get them in.
Yeah, no, that's right. I talk to most of our customers once, twice, sometimes 3 times a week, but they always once a week. Everyone knows roughly what the week ahead's, what I'm planning for the week ahead, what I'm sort of looking at targeting, what they can expect.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's good. Endless
Endless conversations.
Endless conversation with chefs.
Yeah. Out on the boat and some chef's calling you. He's like, oh, you out there now? Any you know, passion fruit trout around?
Yep.
Come on, mate. I'm just trying to fish, mate. Yeah, I think just going back to that shinkajime technique as well, the only place that I've ever seen that done with small species, you see it done on boats with billfish and tuna, like you say, but I think the only place I've seen it done is when they take live fish to market and then process them out of market, and they've got that sort of, you know, time to do it. Yeah. I don't think that happens on boats very much with a smaller species.
No, not a lot. I think with the higher valued bluefin, it might happen at times.
Yeah, with the bigger fish, I think.
I've never actually seen anyone do it with reef fish or smaller fish at all. I know a lot of people told me I was crazy when I started doing it, but I probably am a little bit.
Yeah. Striving for quality always.
That's right. Chris.
All right, let's. I want to ask about the ice slurry as well, and why it's important to. Well, firstly, what it is that just a mixture of seawater and ice?
Basically, Steph. Yeah, that's it, all right. It is. Yeah. Yeah,
and then why is it important to cool the fish down so quickly?
Well, you want it cooled fast. You know, from the second they're pulled from the water, they're starting to deteriorate.
Yeah.
So what you want to do is slow that clock down. You know that timer starts from the second you pull them from the water. So the faster you can cool that core temperature down, the more you're going to increase shelf life. If you put them in hot water or let them sit on the deck, even for 30 seconds, 1 minute, you might not see the difference today, but you'll see the difference in 3, 4, 5 days' time.
Mm.
So okay. It's you want to get them cool fast.
Yeah, and then, what about coming off the boat then? How do you sort of maintain that cool, you know, that all the way through?
Well, that's the good thing with what we do, Steph. Our boats are on trailers, and we've got our own cold room. So when we come in, we don't unload at wharfs or unload anywhere like that in the sun or anything. So we drive the boat in right beside the cold room door, and the fish goes from the boat into the cold room and into the boxes, and it's cool. And so it's, that cold chain's there the whole way through.
Yeah, amazing. And you also, are you obliged by the fishery here and the department? Like, what are your record keeping practices like and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, it is. We've got a lot of paperwork. So when we go out, before we even leave to go to sea, we've got to fill out some paperwork to say we're going out. We've got X amount of crew on. We left at this time of the day. At the end of every day, we've got to fill out, you know, numbers of fish, kilos of fish, where we've fished. We've also got, at the same time, we're getting satellite tracked 24/7. We've got a satellite tracker on the boat that knows where we are every second of the day.
Right.
Then while we're out there, we've got to keep account of every single fish of every species.
Yep.
And before we come home, we've got to ring in Queensland Fisheries number and tell them where we're coming into, exactly what time we're going to be there, and exactly how many fish we've got on. We've got to do that an hour ahead of before we get in, so that way if they say, all right, we want to go and check Chris today, we'll meet him at Carramine Beach boat ramp at 1 o'clock this afternoon. He's got to have this many fish on.
Yeah, right.
He's been here and all that. So, yeah, there's that. And then when we unload, every fish has to be weighed to the, you know, exactly spot on. Every species has got to be weighed. As soon as every fish is out of the boat, I've got to ring up again, ring in those kilos. That comes off our quota. We've got yearly quotas. And for all that there, we've also got to have paperwork to back all of that up. So, yeah, there's a lot of paperwork involved, Steph. There's paperwork for if we have interactions with endangered species or species of conservation interest.
Does that happen much?
Very rarely.
Yeah. What sort of stuff would it be if you do see stuff?
The main things that I've had anything to do with are Maori wrasse. You know, you'll get maybe 6 or 8 of them a year.
Yeah, okay.
They release well. They all release Well, barramundi cod.
Yeah,
there's a lot of them around now. They've been protected for since 2004. So the numbers, there's a lot of barramundi cod out there now.
Were they a pretty targeted species before they were protected?
Not so much targeted, but they're a common catch when targeting coral trout. They live in the same country.
Yeah, okay.
They take the same baits. But the thing with barramundi cod was they're very docile fish, so spearfishing was actually having a big impact on them.
Same as what they've done with groper down south.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Interesting. Cool. So huge, like we'll talk about, again, like we'll sort of do a bit about sustainability a little bit later, but this all sort of goes towards the process of sustainability of your fishery and of the coral trout and of the reef species fishery up here, which we'll talk about the fishery more generally in a second.
Yeah.
But so the doors of the paperwork's done and the doors of the cold room get closed. And what's next?
Then we, we'll spend generally 4 or 5 hours in that cold room. We'll have a list of, on my way in, I'll be contacting chefs and wholesalers and say, this is what I've got. This is what you can have. I've got all my orders sorted, which sometimes is a bloody bit of a job in itself.
I'm sure.
Then Kim will be at home. I'll text her and say, righto, we've got this for Martin's, this for Brisbane, this for, text her all the different orders. So she'll make up the boxes. She'll have all the packing things ready to go. Everything's all ready to go. So we put the fish in there. We're in there for 4 or 5 hours generally packing fish, which even if I get home at lunchtime, we won't start till about 9 or 10 o'clock at night.
Wow.
So yeah, it's that way. It's in the boxes for minimal time,
Yeah,
goes in them boxes. It gets packed. It goes to the airport. It's down there, within hours.
Yeah, right. And then straight on a cold flight to Sydney or Melbourne.
Yeah,
or
Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne,
wherever it goes,
Orpheus Island, wherever. Yeah, all around Australia, Adelaide.
Yeah, great. And so do you sort of like? Are you particular about the wholesalers and stuff that you work with?
Yeah, we won't. We get a lot of inquiries about fish stuff, but I've sort of I am very fussy about who we sell to. We won't just sell to anyone, even if we did ever have excess fish, which we don't. I won't just sell to anyone. That doesn't matter. Like a couple of times we've been offered prices much higher than what we charge, where just money won't make me sell fish to anyone. I'm sort of very, very particular about who we sell to, and the people we sell to now, we've sold to them for a few years now, and they've been loyal to us, we're loyal to them, and it works well,
keeps you happy. And I mean, sort of take you back to when you were first sort of getting going and establishing your business and things like that, was sort of this top premium level of quality and attention to detail across everything you do. Was that something you wanted to do from the beginning? Was that something that sort of developed as you went on?
That was sort of something I wanted to do when I was a kid, actually, believe it or not. I'd see, back in them days, Steph, it was... I look back at it now, and even my dad looks back at it now and goes, Jesus, how were we selling that fish back in them days?
Yeah, right.
I used to see the fish when we first caught them, and I'd think, geez, I'd love to be able to get some of this fish down to cities, or imagine what people would think if we could give them fish that looked and tasted like this, which... So I'd sort of thought about it for a long time, and then... when I first started fishing was for my uncle on a prawn trawler up in Torres Straits. And he was very quality orientated. At the time, I didn't like it much because I used to get my ass kicked for, any little mistakes. And that got... And he was very successful, actually. One of the most successful trawler fishermen that I know of. And basically, that was all quality. Over the years, I worked for some not so good fishing operations mm-hmm. before I had my own business. And, you know, I took it all in and saw that overall the ones that were concentrating on quality more were the ones that were doing better. They weren't necessarily catching the most fish, but they seemed to be doing better, you know. And it just all came together. When I started my own business, I thought, right, I'm not really going to concentrate on quantity. I want to concentrate on quality. I don't want to be wasting fish. Like, probably one thing that really made me realise that was, you know, some of the fish I'd see that was brought in, I wouldn't eat it myself. And the prices, you know, I know the prices were low. Even today, average wharf prices are very low. Mm. But, and when you look at it, wild caught reef fish, it's one of the best bloody foods on the planet.
It's amazing.
It should be equal with, you know, premium grade Wagyu steak.
Yeah, it definitely should.
So I thought, you know, that there's only one way to achieve them sort of prices, and that's quality. And it's going well for me, yeah.
Yeah, cool. And so how did you sort of get it out there that this is what you're doing and that you were doing something different? Did it take sort of conversations with certain wholesalers and chefs that you already had a relationship with to say, look, I'm going to do this thing where my fish is going to be expensive, but I'm going to be able to tell you with total transparency every step of the way, like you've just done, what I do to ensure that this is the best fish you can get?
Yeah, it was funny, actually. You know, for a few years, when Kim and I started our own business, we were just doing what everyone else did, wholesaling, basically catching as much as we could for a set price. And I just had enough, you know. I said to Kim, we can't do this. We've got to do what I'd originally planned to do. And I rang around a lot of fishermen right around Australia. I said, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to do concentrate on the premium market, premium quality, high prices, catch less fish but get more money for it. And I can't even think of one person that said go for it, you know. They all told me I was mad.
Yeah.
And I had to spend probably 50 grand just to get started. Everyone said you're crazy if you're going to spend that, you know, buy a bigger boat, catch more fish. That's what you want to do. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to do it anyway. So I went and spent the money, and at the time I wasn't on social media. I hated social media. I wouldn't even look at it. And one of my friends said to me, you've got to get on the social media, you know. That's the only way these days, you know. I know you don't like it, but in this day and age, if you're not on social media, I went, oh, well, you know what, I'll give it a go. Within no time, I had a couple of restaurants contact me. Zach Sykes was the first chef. I think he was at Jellyfish in Brisbane at the time. He started buying fish, and then, of course, being a chef, they all talked to each other, and he put me on to more and more and more, and it grew. I couldn't believe how fast it grew, actually.
Mm, great. So, and I think that's like, you know, social media can be a good and a bad place. And, you know, that's definitely when it comes to producers, it's given them a platform to, you know, show what they do to the customer. And then when there's high profile chefs out there, people running some of the, you know, best restaurants in Australia using your product, and then sort of, you know, chefs just love good produce. Posting about your product, saying this is the most fantastic stuff. They've got people that follow them all within your target market, essentially, that go, geez, okay, what's this? And then they just get put onto you, and that sort of perpetuates. Did it feel like, tell us a bit about when you sort of started winning awards at Delicious and stuff like that. Was that like a good affirmation that, you know, you really made the right call that time when everyone told you not to do it, but you did it, and and you said, I'm going to chase quality instead of anything else, and we'll see how we go?
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. That was even now when I look back on it, it's still, I don't know. But, Yeah, winning awards, and but not even really winning awards, Steph. It was just having people like, you know, Jocks on Frillo and Gwalami Brahimi and people like that, you know, saying how good my fish was and wanting to use it and, you know, sharing it on their social media. And I thought, you know what, bloody, I'm really glad I did that. And it was definitely worth a step, worth doing. And it proved a lot of people wrong. That was a good feeling.
Yeah. Has anyone around the area or any other commercial fishers in the area sort of started going down the same path? Have you sort of set an example that it's possible for some people?
There is a few lately. There's a few that are getting more into it. Not so much as far as what we do, but it's definitely made a lot of commercial fishermen look more at quality now, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, when we started, that's why everyone told me I was mad. You know, no one that I know of really concentrated on quality. And, you know, fish was a set price back then. We'd been price takers. It was not, you know, you got told, righto, coral trout you get $20 for. So it didn't matter if you bring in 7-day-old coral trout that you wouldn't eat yourself, or if you brought it in that was caught 2 hours ago, $20, that was it.
Yep.
You know, so no one, I don't think at the time many fishermen realised that you don't have to be a price taker. If you set that quality, well, you know, you set the price. Basically, you set the price. So when I did it, I think it made a lot of fishermen sit back and go, geez, you know what, maybe we should look more at quality and less at quantity.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, well, that's, I mean, it's something to be proud of as well, to sort of a proof of concept, really, is what you've done and allows for more people to do that. And I think that's happening across, you know, numerous different types of products and industries and things like that. There's people out there that have made a name for themselves, you know, whether it's on social media or otherwise, for their quality. And then people are sort of seeking them out to get their produce because chefs are interested in the best that they can find at you know, certain styles of venues, and they'll chase that. So it's kind of evangelized producers to follow that model in whatever it might be, because as soon as, you know, someone like Jock or whoever it might be has that product on their menu and gives you a shout out and says, I haven't seen fish like this, or I haven't seen, you know, spuds like this, or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
It sort of sets those wheels in motion, like what happened for you.
Yeah, no, that's right. And you know, chefs like that, they realise that we can't sell that product for the same as average quality. They realise there's extra costs involved. It's not going to be cheap, but they, you know, of course everyone's got a budget, but to them, quality's the most important thing. You know, of course, it's going to end up more expensive on their menu, no doubt about that, but if they want to have the best, and you know, I've spoken to Jock a couple of times, and people like that, we're very similar, you know. They're like me. They just want the best. I want the best. They want the best. They know I can't do it for low prices.
They're happy to pay it.
Yeah, they're happy to pay. So, yeah.
Yeah, cool. All right, let's move on, and we'll finish with just a bit about sustainability, because there are misconceptions about seafood sustainability out there, and I know that there's a documentary that's just been released that might perpetuate some of those misconceptions. But do you see, is the amount of coral trout out on the reef where you're fishing now, like, how do you see that in comparison to what you saw when you were younger?
Well, believe it or not, Steph, I'm catching more now than I've ever seen before out here.
Wow.
You know, my dad still comes with me now, and sometimes he just shakes his head. He's like, you know, I've never seen these sort of amounts of trout consistently. Yeah, we've got better technology, you know, some of the sounders, and we've got GPS, of course, things like that. We have got better, but overall, coral trout especially, I don't think we've got any problems whatsoever with coral trout.
And do you think that that's because of the nature of the species? Like you were talking about before, they breed well, they're resilient fish, and, you know, they grow over large areas in different habitats and things like that.
Yeah, that's right. They're very fast growing. They breed well. Another thing is we've got 30% green zones on the Great Barrier Reef. So 30% of the Great Barrier Reef is no take, no yep. fishing, no. So, you know, that alone is a big help. At the time, a lot of the commercial fishing industry really was dead against the green zones when it came in. That was in 2004. But, yeah, now I think everyone's sitting back going, you know what, that was a bloody good idea at the time.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's interesting because there's a lot of controversy about marine protected areas happening in New South Wales right now. So, yeah it's an interesting observation from a commercial fisherman.
Yeah, no. Well, for up here, it has definitely helped. But, yeah, you know, we've got quotas, very strict quotas. If you go 1 kilo over your quota, you're in for a fine straight away.
Right. And so is there a fishery, like is there a reef fish fishery in this area that you're a part of, that you're a part of a fleet or a part of?
Yeah, well, it's a reef line fishery, so you've got to have the reef line fishery symbol on your license.
Right.
I think there's about 330 in Queensland with that symbol. Yeah, you know, it's all quoted. Each species is quoted. There's a fair bit of research. We do quite a bit of research with Queensland Fisheries. Like I say, we've got satellite monitoring. We've got all this paperwork. So they're getting better and better with the data. They've been a bit behind in the past, but they are getting better. They're a little bit behind on the recreational side of things at the moment. With COVID, the recreational side's increased dramatically.
Yeah.
They probably need to catch up there a bit. But, yeah, overall, at the moment, Steph, yeah, the fish stocks, in my opinion, especially coral trout, are as good as they've been. Some of the deep water stuff that's slower growing, you know, some of that probably needs to be looked at. But even then, it's a long way from being in dire straits, that's for sure.
Mm. Well, that's really promising. Yeah, promising stuff. Yeah. We recently mentioned this because I saw in a recent Instagram post, but we recently spoke to Bill Holden, who's a outreach officer for the Marine Stewardship Council, and you sort of mentioned that these sorts of certifications don't bring enough value to your product to allow for the cost. Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? We won't spend too long on it, but is there any opportunity for sort of the whole fishery to get licensed or anything like that? Like, I mean, as you or certified, as you say, fish stocks have been stronger than almost ever, which is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, Steph. The biggest problem with those sorts of things is cost. You know, by all accounts, the reef line fishery, the fish stocks are in good shape. We have very, very minimal interactions with endangered species or species of conservation interest. We don't have a lot of impact on the environment overall. And, you know, especially myself as a reef guardian, we go above and beyond what we're required.
Yeah, tell us a bit about
already.
The Reef Guardian program, yeah.
Oh, so basically the Reef Guardian program, it's they don't recognise us as sustainable. It just recognises that we go above and beyond what we're required by law. So things like steel sinkers, you know, we've got solar power, we've got, yeah, you look around our yard, native trees everywhere, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So more than we're actually legally required. So, but, you know, back to the certification thing, like I talked to AMCS, Australian Marine Conservation Society, and people like that. And by all accounts, WWF, they're the same. The reef line fishery is one of the most well-managed, sustainable fisheries in the world already. My thing is I just don't see don't see the value in paying for. Someone's got to pay for that.
Totally.
And it won't be me. And it'll be the end, you know, the consumer that'll pay for it.
Exactly. And I think that at the end of the day, if you're selling everything you catch, and if you sell everything that you have the capacity to catch, then it doesn't make a difference one way or the other. I think that within yourself, you've got the ability to be transparent on your social media and on your website and on the information you put out about your practices. It's all recorded. So if there's ever anyone that wants to go through the joys of looking through your catch records and your GPS, you know, monitors or whatever it might be, then they can do it and you're fine with that. So at the end of the day, it doesn't make much difference. And I think that that's like across industries like production and also hospitality that are low margin industries where, you know, it's making a very small percentage of people very rich.
That's right.
You just can't afford to pay for stuff that doesn't really matter to you as much as a symbol might help.
No, that's right. You know, for big volume fisheries, selling the Coles and Woolies and places like that, them sort of things might help. But yeah, at the end of the day, like I say, Steph, if we get hit with that charge, it's got to be passed on. I can't absorb them costs. Yeah. Restaurants can't absorb them costs.
Mm.
It all gets passed on. And, you know, like you say, anyone that wants to can look up, I mean, well, not anyone, but Fisheries Queensland, who manages the fisheries, they know exactly where every single fish I've caught, exactly how many fish I've caught, the numbers, the species, the kilos. There's not much, even if we were certified, nothing would change in the way we operate. Not a single thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So
there you go. Cool. All right, let's finish it off. I've eaten your fish at restaurants and stuff like that. I've never been out and bought it. Can people buy it retail?
Yeah. Fish Factory in Brisbane always put some in their retail display.
Yep.
And Martin's in Sydney, they have an online. Not all the time, but when they do big orders or when I do catch extra, you know, during peak times, they'll have an online thing there where you can buy a little bit, but generally it gets sold fast, Steph. So generally restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, we just don't catch the volume really for retail.
Yeah, well, you mentioned before as well that before we started that, I mean, when it comes to sustainability, it's another point worth mentioning is that you don't even fill your quota each year.
No, we always have quota left over, so it's, you know, and every kilo, whether we catch it or not, we've got to pay for it. But yeah, I'm not, I don't go out and just catch fish just for the sake of filling quota.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, cool. If people want to follow your Instagram, which is one of my favorite ones to check out when you're on the water, it's always great. If you like me and you're into fishing, commercial fishermen are great to follow because they're on the water 300 days a year or whatever it might be, a lot of times. So what's your Instagram account again?
Just Chris Bolton Fishing.
Perfect. Give him a follow. Chris, mate, it's been a pleasure to talk to you and I'm so glad, you know, to be up here in Cairns for something completely different, but to be able to have the opportunity to come down and say good day and check out what you're doing is fantastic. Thanks for joining me.
No, thanks a lot to you, Steph.
Cheers, mate. Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip? elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.